We are rolling.
Get my clicker.
Oh, they're doing the. They're doing the dumpster. I'll wait like 45 seconds for the bang to stop. Hello. I didn't recognize you who have just joined us. But you're welcome here.
This is not your grave, but you are welcome in it.
Hello. Okay. Let's actually start rolling here. Chapter 8. Reactions and Overreactions. Part 1. The Ministry of Magic. 4 August 1993. 8:30 a.m. With a tremendous whoosh, Harry Potter passed through the green flames of the fluid Longbottom Manor and stepped into the atrium of the Ministry of Magic. Lady Augusta followed behind, while Artemis Podmore was waiting on the other side for them both. Once through, Harry paused to look around in wonder. He had never... There we go. He had never been to the Ministry before, but so far it lived up to his expectations. The atrium was a massive, cavernous area decorated in an Art Deco style. Around its perimeter... Around its... Damn it. Okay. Around its perimeter were scores of brightly lit flues from whence scores upon scores of Ministry personnel came and went. Until he saw for himself just how packed the atrium was, even this early in the morning, Harry had never truly appreciated just how many witches and wizards were Ministry... Harry had never truly appreciated just how many witches and wizards were Ministry employees. Then he relaxed his occlumency and looked again, using the senses both nuanced and more obscure than mere vision. Suddenly, all around him, Harry could feel an undercurrent of tension and fear. Of the people moving around the atrium, perhaps one in four had their wands out and gripped tightly in their hands as if expecting an attack at any moment. High on the walls of the four corners of the atrium, balconies had been hastily constructed for use by Auror sniper detachments, armed not with wands, but with magical battle staves that had previously been mothballed since the end of the Wizarding War. At the far side of the atrium, just past the garish... At the far side of the atrium, just past the garish bit of statuary known as the Fountain of Magical Brethren, which was the entryway to the Ministry proper, and was now guarded by 2 10-foot-tall security trolls. The behemoths growled softly at the nervous witch... Kill me. The behemoths growled softly at the nervous wizards and witches standing in line for magical identification, as if they were waiting for a chance to smash a Death Eater with the clubs they carried, For just a second, Harry was overcome by a miasma of barely restrained panic before he reasserted his occlumency shields and dialed down his developing legitimacy senses. Luckily, Mr. X had warned him about the danger of large crowds at this point in his training, and Harry was able to shake off the brief but stifling emotional resonance as his solicitor stepped forward. Fuck my ass, how does Artie talk? It's sort of like this, isn't it? Isn't this how Artie talks? I believe Clark will be the most, Oh, maybe not. I was going to say Clark might be the most recently affiliated with the voice of Artemis Podmore. Maybe not nasal, but, God damn it, I'm going to have to find out speaking, aren't I? God, fuck, okay. I remember it being a voice that I felt was kind of niche, but also not hard to remember, but that's back when I was doing it every day. Is it more like this? Was it sort of this? I remember it being just a little bit into this sort of Anna Chu, Katie Bell situation, but... I don't know that he does. It's just that I'm trying to remember how he fucking talks. Faster. God damn. Okay. Can someone tell me, like, an arty heavy chapter? Okay. That would have been, what number would that have been of year two? On the importance of emotion, that's chapter 10. Okay, yeah, no, that'll definitely be the one.
All right, let me find the fucking... find the goddamn... rough fucking...
This was easier when I was doing it every day. I say that like it's not my fault I stopped. Well, it's sort of actually Matt's fault that I stopped, but... Let me see... T.S. Man, Prince of Slytherin, T.S.C. Rough, Chapter 10 Rough. That's a, no, I opened the peak file. Fuck that. No, okay. I'll blame what I damn well want on that. Oh, God. Oh, wow. I just shit my old, Rita Skeeter voice. Oh, I can do a much better one now.
I was just sort of doing it like this before. No, this is my Rita Skeeter. It's much more breathy.
I'm about to hit already dialogue. My God. It's just sort of, I just talk like this. That is what it is. But oh my God. My British accents are so much better now than they were then. I'm not saying they're amazing now, but like, my God, it was barely there. And that was the beginning of chapter or book two. You think so, Clark? I don't know. I mean, it might be. Well, me barking ass dog, stop barking. What's wrong with you? Oh, I'm gonna need help with the group voice again. I need to do another India session for sure. Oh my God, what is that dog barking at? I don't know if I've heard that dog before. Did somebody that lives near me get a loud dog? Welcome to Sam Gabriel Records Harry Potter fanfiction. It's a lot of this. Yeah, I'm asking you that, Takiko. You Germans have a good spy network, right? Tell me what my neighbors are doing. Well, speaking of, well, the dog's barking. I do have some reading material. Let's see. Schön Sie sich nicht dämlich in Keiten des Ultra Voice beim Abmischen ausreisen. Denn oftmals sind okay, I'll stop this now. For context, Skiko recently middlemanned me a spare of a German-produced outboard audio processor that I use, and it came with a German manual. I know. Okay, listen. I know that it. I know. Okay, hang on. Let me actually try and do that for real. I'm mostly just doing it to make Sakiko twitch. But okay, where is it? Okay. Scheuen Sie sich nicht. Die Möglichkeiten des Ultra Voice beim Abmischen auszureizen. I know, I at least know how a Z is supposed to be. As in 1, 2, Polizei, 3, 4, Grenadier, 7, 6, 8, 7, 8, Gute Nacht. I know that. Fuck you. Fuck yourself, Sakiko. Fucking helpful ass fucking person, does a lot of favors for me. Fucking. I mean, if you want to know how a white American man voices an Italian woman, like, I'm pretty sure I uploaded the Serena session. I've recorded all of Serena's lines. God, it might still be all of Serena's lines. I don't know if she's appeared past the point where she took Harry to the fucking magical Faraday cage in year four. Anyway, okay. Let's actually record a fucking fanfiction. Ohana, that'll be the note that things are back to normal. Good morning, Harry. Lady Augusta, Artie said genially. That remains to be seen, Solicitor Podmore, Augusta said grimly. An emergency session of the Wizengamot. This had never ended well in the past, and I fear today's will go no better. The magical solicitor nodded. True, however, this does represent an unusual opportunity for Harry here to see the Wizengamot in full session. Usually that... Usually that only happens while he's away at... Usually that only happens while he's away at Hogwarts. I do wish you'd consented to allow young Neville to come today for the same reason. Neville is abroad, Agatha said with a touch of coldness, as if to remind Podmore that he was not her solicitor and had no say in Neville's upbringing. Given the history between the Longbottoms and Lestrangers, that is where he will stay, until the situation is resolved, or he returns to Hogwarts, whichever comes first. In fact, immediately after news of the Azkaban jailbreak had made the papers, Augusta owled a letter to Neville in Africa forbidding him to return to Longbottom Manor until further notice, supposedly out of concerns that the Lestranges might still have the means to bypass the Longbottom wards. She also instructed Reginald Long... She also instructed Reginald...
The thing is, I got, like, the veriest hint of a maybe sneeze in there. I don't think it's going to come to anything like that.
She also instructed Reginald Long... Reginald, what is wrong with me? She also instructed Reginald Longbottom to secure their African farms and keep a low profile until she contacted them again, either when the Lestranges had been recaptured or when it was time for Neville to return to Hogwarts, whichever came first. Of course, if things went according to plan... Of course, if things went according to plan, the Lestranges would never be recaptured by the Ministry, or indeed be heard from again. Still, it was the exact same thing she'd have said and done had not been a part of Regulus's conspiracy, and so it was fully in character for her. As the trio left the flue, Harry and Artie stopped off at Ministry Munchies for a quick Danish and pumpkin juice, while Augusta left straight away for the Wizengamot level to change into her official robes. So, how are you holding up with all this pandemonium? He asked before biting into his breakfast. Harry shrugged noncommittally. To be honest, he lied easily, it hasn't affected me at all. Certainly not like it has Neville or Lady Augusta. Well, it certainly affected your father. My understanding is they kept him in an interrogation room in his pajamas and bathrobe for several hours on Sunday morning after the break. Do Brits say pajamas or pajamas? Do they say the word at all? Okay, one is pajamas, two is pajamas. Okay. Like, I say pajamas as well, but, yeah. My understanding is they kept him in an interrogation room in his pajamas and bathrobe for several hours on Sunday morning after the jailbreak. Him and the minister, too.
Really? Harry replied with a trace of a smile. How awful that must have been, but... Surely no one seriously thought that the Minister and the Chief Auror were really behind it all.
No, but it took that long to rule out either a Confundus or the Imperius. Your father will be delivering his report today. Then we'll see what the Ministry had to say for itself. My concern is that Fudge will be rattled enough and angry enough to propose something truly unwise.
My concern is that Fudge will be rattled enough and angry enough to propose something truly unwise. You don't like Fudge, do you? Artie frowned. Like has nothing to do with it. If the Death Eaters are back, then he's probably the wrong man for the job. But there's not much that can be done about that now. And in his defense, Fudge himself knows perfectly well that he shouldn't have the job and fell into it by accident. Harry gave him a questioning look, so Artie took another sip. Harry gave him a questioning look, so Artie took another sip of pumpkin juice before relating Fudge's political background. In 1990, Millicent Bagnold declined to run for a third term as minister due to health issues. Albus Dumbledore was asked to stand for the office, but he refused in order of staying at Hogwarts. That left the way open for Bartimus Crouch. Bartimus Crouch Sr. to run virtually unopposed. Fudge at that point was an up-and-coming junior minister with the Department of Magical Accidents and Catastrophes. He threw his hat into the ring for Minister for Magic, but everyone understood that he was just trying to build name recognition for some future office, most likely to get appointed head of the DMAC under a Crouch administration. So what happened? Harry asked. The Quibbler, of all things. It had always been an offbeat satirical publication, but back then it wasn't as, well, patently silly as it is today, and it still regularly published serious pieces along with its customary strangeness. 5 weeks before the election, the Quibbler ran an expose about Crouch's son, Barty Jr., a Death Eater who died in Azkaban after receiving a life sentence from a judicial panel headed by his own father. The story painted Jr. as a well-liked and genial Ravenclaw who fell in with the wrong crowd because his father neglected his family in favor of his political ambitions. It also suggested, somewhat luridly, that Crouch's wife had died of a broken heart after her husband callously ensured the death of her only child. Most of the facts of Junior's case were well known. Most of the facts of Junior's case were well known already, and the whole thing would have been... Nope. And the whole thing would have blown over had Crouch not completely overreacted. He gave an interview to the Prophet in which he said that when he was minister he'd look into having Zeno Lovegood thrown into Azkaban for sedition. That, in turn, led to more stories that cast some of his more ruthless decisions as head of the DMLE during the war in a fairly negative light. Such as? Harry asked. How would it begin? You are aware, I suppose, that during the latter days of the war, Aurors were authorized... You're aware, I suppose, that during the latter days of the war, Aurors were authorized under the Death Eater laws to use unforgivables. Harry nodded. Well, prior to 1990, very few people outside the DMLE and the Wizard Cabinet understood just how freely those Aurors had been permitted to use those forbidden spells. Most common wizards understood that the law only allowed them to use the killing curse in self-defense and had no idea that Aurors were also permitted to use the Cruciatus in interrogations and even to use the Imperius on captured suspects for things like leading Aurors past the defenses of Death Eater safe havens or betraying and attacking other Death Eaters. It wasn't exactly classified, but the number of unforgivables cast by Aurors and the situations in which they were cast had mostly gotten swept under the rug. And Barty Sr. personally authored the legislation that allowed the Aurors to use unforgivables, and then wrote the DMLE guidelines governing how they could be used in the field. It shouldn't surprise you to hear me describe them as lax guidelines. But then the Quibbler pulled that rug away and showed it was hidden underneath. Just so. Crouch may have been fervently opposed to the Death Eaters, but he was also ruthless and reactionary. A Muggleborn might even have described him as fascistic. Nope. A Muggleborn might even have described him as fascistic. And unfortunately for Crouch, he had made it a point to remind everyone of what sort of minister he might make at the worst possible moment. And so everyone voted for Fudge instead, Henry said. Oh, not everyone. Oh, not everyone. The election of 1990, a contest between a ruthless and unlikable authoritarian and an amiable dunce, was one of the closest in the... A contest between a ruthless and unlikable authoritarian and an amiable dunce was one of the closest in the history of wizarding Britain, with unsupported accusations of vote-buying and other improprieties on both sides. I voted for Fudge, but it was a protest vote. I'd honestly expected him to lose. Crouch only conceded when Fudge agreed to appoint him senior minister for the Department of... Crouch only conceded when Fudge agreed to appoint him senior minister for the Department of International Magical Corporation and also Britain's chief delegate to the ICW, two titles that gave Crouch international authority that trumped that of the Minister for Magic when dealing with international wizarding affairs.
I've fairly consistently been saying Minister for Magic, even though the text says Minister of Magic, right? I feel like I have been. My issue with it is that I have a lot of trouble saying Minister of Magic in a British accent. That's very difficult for me to do because... And not about this. I mean, like... I'm talking about just in the audiobook shit. That could have been months. I don't know. No, it isn't. It's supposed to be Minister for Magic. It's a British print, American print thing. Minister of Magic is the American print. Minister for Magic is the British one. The idea being that the post is like. It's basically, I don't remember what any of the actual names of the posts are in England, but when there's a minister for something, he's always the minister for that thing in England, and Minister for Magic was something kind of a little joke on that. I think is whenever I've heard any British, the only person I've ever heard say Minister of Magic in a British accent is Jim Dale. Because Jim Dale narrated the American versions. I think my art, I remember actually, I'm vaguely remembering this now. I think the argument was like, you say Philosopher's Stone, so you should say Minister for Magic as well. Anyway.
Wait, so Fudge just bolt off his chief rival? Everyone knows about it? Artie shrugged. That particular form of influence peddling isn't exactly illegal under... That particular form of influence peddling isn't actually illegal under wizarding law. In fact, it's basically a tradition for an incoming minister to reward... In fact, it's basically a tradition for an incoming minister to reward whoever finished second with a prominent position of some sort. Usually it's just a ceremonial one, but Crouch was certainly qualified to be minister for the DIMC, and it's a position where he couldn't do much harm to fight his domestic agenda or pers-
I'm gonna kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Stop texting me, please.
But Crouch was certainly qualified to beam in it.
God in heaven!
But Kratz certainly was qualified to be minister for the DIMC, and it's a position where he couldn't do much harm to fight his domestic agenda or personal popularity, but I digress. The end result was that Fudge, basically an okay but inexperienced fellow, unexpectedly landed in the minister's chair and has been winging it ever since. And worse, though Fudge has never been a blood purist, or if he is, he's hidden it well, his base of support consisted heavily of suspected Death Eaters who were hell-bent on keeping Crouch out of the minister's position. And to his credit, Fudge has made a point of relying on a diverse group of advisors, but especially Albus Dumbledore, and as far as anyone knows, he's never taken any personal bribes. Personal bribes? Harry interrupted. What other kind is there? Artie chuckled. Usually donations to Fudge's pet causes, which again is not technically illegal as long as he doesn't personally benefit from those causes, other than sales tax levied on wizarding goods and services offered by privately held companies. Nearly all of the government's income is derived from fees that wealthy families pay to maintain their Wizengamot privileges. Since the rich elites are basically paying for the governments anyway, it's generally considered acceptable for this or that family to donate large sums of galleons for particular government projects. Yeah. It's generally considered acceptable for this or that family to donate large sums of galleons for particular government projects. This family pays for a new wing for St. Mungo's, that family pays for new dragonhide armor for the Auror Corps, etc., etc. And it's only proper, in most people's eyes, for them to get certain special considerations in exchange for their largesse.
Is that how you say that?
Or is that in exchange for their largesse?
I'm sure it's one of those two.
This is probably just because I'm muggle-raised, but wizarding culture sounds incredibly corrupt. The older man shrugged. It's a matter of perspective. The muggle government taxes everyone, and so, in theory at least, has to pay attention to every... though it's not a surprise that it pays more attention to wealthier people than the poor. Among wizards, you need galleons to fund government projects, but the wealthy wizards are the only ones who have that much in liquid assets, and so bear the brunt of taxations. Most common wizards don't have a lot of currency because they don't need it. With limited exceptions for food and shelter, magic can give you whatever you need to survive. If you know how to operate, you can transport yourself almost anywhere. If you're good with transfiguration, you can make most everyday items you need. If you know the Reparo Charm, nearly anything tangible you buy will last a lifetime or longer. In all of Diagon Alley, there are only four... In all of Diagon Alley, there are only four stores that sell clothing, because only rich wizard folk, or wizard folk who want to be perceived as rich, bother to pay for clothing produced by other wizards instead of simply transfiguring out of use gargum. I believe the comparable muggle term is post-scarcity society. Most wizard folk only need galleons in large quantities if they decide to create a business of... And they usually get the money from investors among the... old rich families. Harry wasn't entirely sure what post-scarcity meant, so he made a mental note to ask Hermione about it later. So basically, most wizards and witches can take care of their own personal needs. So, basically, most wizards and witches can take care of their own personal needs without any aid from the government, but for big society stuff, I guess. The ministry provides it and pays for it with taxes, mainly paid by the wealthiest families in exchange for all special favours. A crude but accurate summation, Artie said. And if you think Fudge is bad, you'd have hated Millicent Bagnold. She was the one who signed off on dismissing all charges against Duns... She was the one who signed off on dismissing all charges against dozens of marked Death Eaters who claimed with little supporting evidence to have been under the Imperius. She concluded that Sirius Black's confession made convicting most of them an impossibility, so she agreed to dismiss most of the remaining prosecutions of those... if those accused paid out enough galleons to essentially rebuild our entire society after a decade of constant destructive war... Artie glanced at his watch. But we could continue the history lesson later, and we'd best head towards the gallery. There's still a long line at the security checkpoint. We'll get there in time, Harry asked. No fears, Harry, Artie said with a slight grimace. Roll call will probably take a full hour. Nine o'clock a.m. An opulent London high-rise apartment overlooking the Thames. Blaise Zabini had only just risen from his bed when he heard the soft pop that marked the arrival of his temporary houseguest. He frowned at the clock. The thought of being up this early during the summer vacation was appalling, but Harry had asked for his help. Help that Blaze had reassured the other boy that only he was capable of giving. Indeed, Blaze was quite certain he knew exactly what Harry Potter needed in this instance, even if the other boy did not. And so the boy pulled on his robe over his pajamas and sauntered into the living... room where the Countess's British house elf, Domo, was standing guard over the new arrival. From Harry's description, the twitchy, terrified elf who Domo regarded so suspiciously could only be... Dobby, I presume? Blaze inquired. The U.S. isn't that fucking heterogeneous. It's basically just red states and blue states, and there's patches of both in both. The poor creature practically jumped at being addressed by a wizard.
Yes, I was being Dobby, sir.
He said in a cringing tone before handing a letter of introduction over to Domo, who snatched it up, checked it for baleful magic, and then handed it to Blaze. The boy reviewed the note, which, as expected, was a letter from Harry confirming that this was his elf Dobby, and that he was placing Dobby into his care for a few days for training. Oh, and that Harry would be very, very cross if any harm came to Dobby, or if he were mistreated any more than he already had been at Malfoy Manor back before Dobby... before Draco stopped being a git... Blaze snorted softly and pocketed the letter. "Do you understand why you were here, Dobby?" he asked. Dobby nodded violently.
Because Dobby is a worthless, stupid, horrible excuse for an elf."
That was Scottish. Dobby's Irish.
Because Dobby is a worthless, stupid, horrible excuse for an elf."
And with that, Dobby began to wail and weep piteously. Next to him, Domo said nothing but rolled his eyes to register his disdain for the display. "Zip it," Blaze said forcefully, and instantly, Dobby gained a measure of control over himself, though he did make a point of blowing his nose on the hem of his dingy tea towel tunic.
"'Zip
You are here, the boy continued, to learn how to be a proper servant for Harry Potter. Do you want to be a house elf worthy of Harry Potter?
Oh, yes,
Dobby said excitedly.
Nah,
Dobby said excitedly.
Master Harry Potter is the greatest, most powerful...
Nah.
Master Harry Potter is the greatest, most wonderful wizard in all the world. Dobby would do anything.
Zip it, Blaze snapped again. Harry Potter sent you to me because he trusts my judgment about what is needed to make you a proper servant for him. And believe me when I tell you that only the best, most perfect servant is what Harry Potter needs right now. Nothing less will do. Are you willing to Are you willing to trust me as your master does and follow my instructions regarding how to serve him better? Dobby swallowed deeply.
Dobby will follow Master Harry's...
Ah!
Dobby will follow Master Harry's friend's wisdom.
Nope.
Dobby will follow Master...
Nah.
Dobby will follow Master Harry's friend's wisdom.
Good. Blaze turns to the other elf. Domo, you may return to your duties. I will take breakfast at 9:30 out on the balcony. Fruit Loops with whole milk and a carafe of French... Fruit Loops with whole milk and a carafe of French... French, I keep saying French. Fruit Loops with whole milk and a carafe of fresh orange juice, if you please.
At once, Master Blaze, Domo said with approval for Blaze's menu choice. Then he glanced over to Dobby and lifted his chin haughtily before disappearing with a pop.
Right, come over here, Dobby. Blaze led the elf over to the other side of the room, where sat many strange and arcane objects, the likes of which Dobby had never seen before. This is technology, Dobby. Specifically a big screen TV and a VCR. Think of it as muggle magic. It is not compatible with your magic, so you must not touch any of this yourself or you might damage it. But on this screen will be projected moving pictures that will tell stories to show you how to best serve Harry Potter.
No.
Stories that will tell you how best to serve Harry Potter. When one story is finished, come and find me, and I will swap out the videotape for another. Do you understand?
Dobby nodded affirmatively. Although he knew nothing of TVs or VCRs, the basic instructions so far were within his grasp. Blaze then removed a videotape from a plastic case and inserted it into the VCR before... and inserted it into the VCR before holding the tape case so that Dobby could see its front cover.
Do you see those two muggles, Dobby? Good. Now, as you watch the show, I want you to pay particular attention to these two people. And I want you to imagine that this thin man is Harry Potter, and that this larger man who is his servant is you. Try to imagine responding to your master as this servant does to his. Do you understand? Do you understand?
The house elf furrowed his brow.
Dobby thinks so. Dobby will do his best.
Good. Now sit comfortably and watch the whole program. With that, Blaze pressed the play button and then returned to his room to shower and get dressed, while Dobby sat on the floor and watched the television screen in wonderment as a jaunty fiddle and bass tune began to play and words appeared as if by magic. Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie as Jeeves and Wooster.
This article, his name is now Article Podmore.
Oh, dear God. That's a very funny, funny thing you just said, Bass, and you don't even know why, and I'm not going to tell you. No, I was actually watching the indicator on the Discord just now. It just like wasn't transmitting most of the time. I was laughing for some reason. I don't know why. It's probably just like the noise filter or something. Yeah, no, Bass, there's something that only three people in this call know that cannot be shared. Like, we literally can't tell you. It was so funny that we had to comment on it, though. Yeah, sorry. Like, it's like not fair to you, but it's... I've been rolling for 48 minutes and there's been a lot of faff in this. Can I do the rest of it? Actually, Matt, here's a question for you. Matt, who's totally in the fucking car. Oh, okay. Thank you, Ohana. Okay. I'm gonna blow through. Enough of the fucking bullshit. I'm gonna blow through the rest of this chapter. I'm gonna do it. There's no reason I can't. It'd be stupid if I didn't. I was actually thinking what the sperm whale said in Hitchhikers. Okay. Okay, let's do it.
The Wizengamot Chambers, 9:45 a.m. After a long wait in the newly installed security line, Harry and Artie were finally allowed in, and Artie led the boy down into the bowels of the Ministry of Magic to the lowest level, where the Wizengamot had already begun its emergency session. How could the Ministry possibly maintain a 10-story structure underneath Whitehall without Muggles having any idea? Harry asked. Well, not that far from the Thames. Why doesn't this place flood, or at least feel damp? Magic? Artie... Artie replied with a smirk. You know, Artie, after a while it gets old hearing magic offered as an answer to every serious question. Fair enough, Harry. Now, how about... How about ancient, powerful, centuries-old magic using master-level spatial expansion and notice-me-not charms, backed by the combined magical power of all the ancient oaths sworn by the original Wizengamot families. Oh, and master-level waterproofing charms as well, I suppose. See, was that so hard? Harry said with a smile. Excruciating, Artie replied dryly. Though innocuously labeled simply as Courtroom 10, the Wizengamot Chamber was roughly the size of the Hogwarts Great Hall, but circular in shape. The public viewing gallery where Harry and Artie entered consisted of a single, large balcony blocked off by various charms, wards, and spells to prevent observers from interfering in any way with Wizengamot proceedings. Even sounds were blocked, so observers could talk freely without... Even sounds were blocked, so observers could talk freely without being heard by those below. The viewing gallery overlooked an open area called the Well, which presently has several tables set up for use by Chief Aura Potter, DMLE Director Bones, and Minister Fudge, along with their various adjutants. Immediately, Harry noticed that while most of those officials seemed tense but otherwise comfortable in their surroundings, one of the minister's assistants seemed a bit out of place, and she continually looked around the chamber as if she could not quite believe where she had found herself. The woman appeared middle-aged, short, and a bit stoutish, and Harry immediately decided that she bore an unfortunate resemblance to a giant toad. Then he chastised himself.
Oh! I wonder if there have been any other Salazar quotes in POS. Because now I can do ACB POS! ACB Salazar in POS!
Appearance is no guarantee of character or competence, as Salazar Slytherin himself had noted in his memoirs, and Harry decided that it was un-Slytherin of himself to judge the Toad Woman on that basis. For all he knew, she might be a very nice lady.
Chief Warlock Albus Dumbledore sat behind an enormous judge's bench, situated on a high platform that loomed over the well opposite the viewing gallery. Harry was strangely pleased to see that his headmaster had eschewed the plum-colored robes worn by the rest of the Wizengamot in favor of the eccentric garb he wore every day at school. Today's robes were particularly bold and featured an eclectic... Today's robes were particularly bold and featured an eclectic mixture of chartreuse and ultramarine. Directly beneath the chief warlock's desk, but on the same general level, were seats for a court reporter, who also acted as a sort of bailiff, and a records keeper. In front of them, but on a lower level, was a row of desks allocated to half a dozen or so ministry officials who held Wizengamot votes by virtue of office. Harry was startled to see Ludo Bagman sitting in that section looking simultaneously confused and bored, but then he remembered that the head of the Department of Magical Games and Sports was, inexplicably, among the offices with a chief... among the offices with an ex officio Wizengamot seat. There was a dour and serious man sitting next to him who seemed visibly affronted at the seating arrangements to judge by the look of disdain he had for Bagman, and Artie soon identified the older man as the very same Bartimeus Crouch Sr. that they'd been discussing earlier. Behind Dumbledore stood a set of double doors from which the Wizengamot members had emerged, surrounding the well of the chamber on either side of the chief warlock where the... Surrounding the well of the chamber on either side of the chief warlock and the ministry seats were three levels of box seating arranged in concentric arcs. The bottom row was for Order of Merlin recipients. To his surprise, Harry noticed an unusually grim Arthur Weasley in that section, wearing official plum robes far nicer than anything he'd ever seen the man wearing before. The middle row was for the noble houses and the top row for ancient and noble houses. Immediately, Harry noticed that there were quite a few empty boxes, especially on the middle tier, and he asked his solicitor about them. "The Wizarding War hit the noble houses particularly hard," Artie said. "Of the 14 noble houses... Of the 14 noble families that have gone extinct as of 1981, only two have been replaced in the years since. Plus this House Gringras, which has been elevated to ancient and noble status and has left an open spot on the noble row as a result." "So why haven't they filled those seats yet?" Harry asked. "Because they can't come to a consensus on who should have them. Think about it. With all those seats empty, the families who are still represented have more power because they control a greater percentage of the votes that can actually be cast. Filling those empty seats would dilute their power, and even more so if they are filled with new families allied with their enemies." Harry nodded and looked around the visitor's gallery, the large balcony overlooking the well of the chamber across from where the chief warlock's seat... During this particular session, the visitor's gallery was open only to members of the press, certain non-voting government officials, and family members and agents of seat holders. So Harry was not terribly surprised to see Draco Malfoy, or now Drake, maybe, he wondered, sitting off to one side watching the proceedings. He was rather surprised to see who Malfoy was sitting with, their Muggle-born classmate Justin Finch Fletchley. After a few seconds of consultation, Artie left to speak to some colleagues while Harry made his way to his fellow students, both of whom greeted him warmly. "Before we go any further, are we using Draco or Drake now?" Harry asked. "Well, we're observing Wizengamot proceedings, so I think Draco would be best in here. My father's still not completely adjusted to my proposed name change." "Fair enough. Also, Justin, please don't take this the wrong way, but how did you get in the door?" Justin smiled. "Draco's father did a thing."
Let's see.
Harry crooked an eyebrow and then turned to Draco. "You've been teaching him how to speak Slytherin." "We had a busy summer. He taught me how to play cricket. I taught him how to be evasive." Harry chuckled as he sat down next to his two friends. "So what have I missed?" "Not much," Justin said. "The roll call is taking forever. We're only up to the ends." "Speak which?" Draco said. Below them, the elderly court reporter called out in a thin, reedy voice.
"The Wizengamot calls Malfoy. Who stands?"
From a box on the top row, Lucius Malfoy stood and answered,
"Lord Lucius Malfoy speaks for the Malfoy seat. 27 votes."
Justin whistled softly.
27 votes? That's the most anyone's had so far by a long shot. No wonder everyone at school looks at you funny, Draco.
Said Harry. "Obviously, I slept through Minister of Magic on the day that Binns actually explained how our government works. Why does your father have 27 votes, Draco?"
Get my clicker.
And...
Turn up the radio. I'm
27. Where the fuck were it?
Okay. You guys will have heard some of this already because of the fuck up last time, but.
So
this was following from Harry asking Draco why his father has 27 seats. Or not seats, but votes.
Bids never cover this, Harry, because it falls under the heading of useful information. Ancient and noble houses get 10 votes, noble houses get 5. Then there is a pool of reserved votes that go to the Order of Merlin holders and certain lucky ministry officials. In addition to my family's 10 votes, father still holds fealty from the Crabs, Goyles, and Parkinsons, so that's 4 from each of them out of the 5 to which each of those noble families is entitled. By an amusing technicality, he also holds proxy for the I troubled this last time, too. By an amusing technicality, he also holds proxy for the Lestrange noble seat, at least until all the... at least until all of those nutters finally die off, which is another 5. 10 plus 5 plus 3 4s equals 27, QED. Oh, and Sinister. I just purchased a suite of software which will allow me to make some needed passes over the audio for strangers in Boston very easily. And that will assist the completion of that project very, very, very much. I should have it done by the end of the month, hopefully.
Down. All
right. Harry nodded. Naturally, he was aware in general of how Wizengamot votes were allocated. He had simply wondered where the extra 5 votes from the Lestranges had come from. In fact, his worn copy of Hutchinson's commentary had explained the Wizengamot's history in depth. The original ancient and noble houses were descended from the 17 powerful Roman families who relocated to the British Isles shortly before Rome's fall, and those families spent the next few centuries either warring with one another, interbreeding with one another, or both, until they finally settled their differences and formed the Wizard's Council, the de facto magical government of the British Isles from roughly the 7th century until the Norman Conquest. During that time, only the Hogwarts founders presented any challenge to their informal rule, though it was indeed a powerful challenge that eventually led to a peace treaty between Hogwarts and the Wizards' Council that had held thus far for nearly 10 centuries. In fact, the heavy losses suffered by the Wizards' Council in their futile attempts to conquer Hogwarts left them open to what came next. In 1066 AD, William the Conqueror came a-calling, and in the wake...
Damn it.
And in the wake of his successful invasion of Britain, another 29 Norman, Breton, and French wizarding families relocated to... And French wizarding families relocated to William's new kingdom and immediately challenged the power of the Wizards' Council. The conflict between the powerful and entrenched Roman... The conflict between the powerful and entrenched Roman families and the younger and more numerous invader families continued for decades, long after the Normans themselves had subjugated Britain. Finally, one member of the Wizards' Council, whose original family name was now lost, broke his family's alliance with the other ancient families and ultimately engineered... And ultimately engineered a peace treaty between the warring magical... And ultimately engineered a peace treaty between the... Oh, fuck. and ultimately engineered a peace treaty between the warring magical factions. The result was the Wizengamot, a new magical government in which all of the families held power jointly, but with the member families of the old Wizards Council granted additional voting privileges due to seniority. The Betrayer family was allowed to hold its ancient and noble status, but in a final show of petulance, the other Wizards Council members cursed that family's line so that its true name would be lost forever, and it would only be known as House Badfaith, or House Malfoy, in the language of the Norman Conquerors. As he mentally reviewed that ancient... As he mentally reviewed that ancient history, Harry was only peripherally aware of the pronouncements from Houses Macmillan and Marchbanks, 5 votes each, and the lack of one from House McKinnon. The court reporter called the name 3 times as a formality, but everyone knew the McKinnon line had been extinct and unreplaced since 1980. But his head jerked up instantly when House Knott was called upon. Tiberius Knott stood for his house.
10 votes.
Then Lord Knott turned his head in the direction of Lucius Malfoy and sneered. Harry said nothing, though his eyes narrowed. He wondered if Draco knew that within a few months the votes of Crabbe, Goyle, and Parkinson would likely shift from Lucius's control to that of Tiberius. Lord Parkinson himself stood next and claimed ownership of the 1 vote he had left, the other 4 still proxied out to Lucius. The names Peverell and Prince were both called out, again as a formality, as they too were extinct, though Harry noticed that Justin stiffened slightly when House Prince was called. Finally, it was House Potter's turn.
Peter Pettigrew, Esquire, Seneschal and proxy for House Potter, speaks for the Potter seat. 23 votes.
Justin looked at Harry in surprise, and he gave the other boys a summarized... account. The Potters are ancient and noble, and so start with 10 votes. James and Lily and Jim each held an Order of Merlin, which is another 3 votes. And then... And then it gets weird, because somehow James holds the proxy for House Black, which gives him another 10 votes. James had explained it all to his heir the previous Christmas. Apparently, Sirius Black, the secret Death Eater who had betrayed the Potters to Voldemort, had for some odd reason also provided James Potter with a power of attorney letter, granting him complete control over Sirius's legal affairs in the event of the latter's incapacity. When Arcturus Black died in 1991, Sirius Black automagically became the new head of House Black, even though he was incarcerated in Azkaban at the time. The Ministry investigated Black's affairs, found the power of attorney, and appointed James Potter as regent for House Black until Sirius Black's eventual death, at which point either the Black seat would go to his heir if a suitable one could be found, or the Black line itself would be deemed extinguished. Harry still found it amusing that... Harry still found it amazing that James could be so certain that Sirius had betrayed him, despite apparently entrusting him with the heart and soul of his family's political power. Apparently entrusting him with the heart and soul of his family's political power.
Is there a black heir? Draco asked. Mother said that if I had gone with her instead of father, there was a good chance I'd become the next Lord Black. But that's out of the picture so long as I remain a Malfoy.
Harry shrugged. I think it depends on if Sirius Black prepared a will or not. If there's no will, House Black will probably go extinct because there are no males to carry the family name.
Unless, of course, Harry thought to himself, Regulus can get past the hurdle of being both a suspected Death Eater and also legally dead.
If he did leave a will, the boy continued, well, he's still my godfather, and I do have black lineage from Dorea Black Potter. It's possible that I could be the next Lord Black if he filled out the right paperwork and I was willing to give up my Potter heir status.
Draco made a face. It's a good thing I don't hate you nearly as much as I used to. Harry laughed.
So I guess this makes the Malfoys and Potters far and away the most powerful families in the Wizengamot? Justin asked.
Good turnout for this one, guys. Glad you're all here.
Is this time of day better for people? Discuss that amongst yourselves whilst I continue.
Draco shook his head with a rueful expression. Unfortunately, no, he said as he pointed back to the court reporter.
The Wizengamot called Silwyn, said the elderly...
said the elderly wizard.
Who stands?
From a box on the top row, two spots over from Lucius, an attractive and relatively young-looking witch stood to address the chief warlock.
Casilda Selwyn, seneschal for the ancient and noble house of Selwyn, speaks for the Selwyn seat, she said in gentle, dulcet tones. 32 votes.
Ancient and noble plus 4 cadet lines, Draco said to the other two boys with a disdainful sniff. The Carrolls, Warringtons, Travers, and Yaxleys are all families that started as offshoots of the Selwyn line before getting elevated to noble status. But they've all since sworn... But they've all still sworn fealty to the Selwyns, so that's 16 votes controlled by the main family. On top of that, they have 5 Altar of Merlin holders, plus a ministry seat holder from among their 5 families. Harry turned his attention to Casilda Selwyn, who spoke for her family but did not claim the title of Lady Selwyn. Although he had only been peripherally aware of the Selwyns for the past 2 years, he had not realized just how much power over the Wizengamot the family possessed. He decided now that the Selwyn family finally... He decided now that the Selwyn family deserved more of his attention. In particular, who was the current Lord or Lady Selwyn, and why weren't they on hands to claim the family seat personally? As the roll call proceeded, Wizengamot pages moved among the various seat holders carrying private messages back and forth. Among them was a single piece of folded stationery delivered to Antonius Warrington. The outside of the stationery bore the Selwyn crest, a white shield with Slytherin green trim and charged with a red rose whose thorns dripped blood. Beneath the shield was the Selwyn family motto.
And I got a file from Ohana on this.
Oh, by the way, I'm not planning on changing the time I do this normally unless there's, like, an overwhelming call for it. I just noticed that this particular session seems quite attended. And, patrons certainly have considerable sway over, decisions like timing, for sure. Where the fuck is the Ohana DMs? God, I have so many ongoing DMs. There's Ohana, okay.
Oderint du metuant. Let them hate so long as they fear. Okay.
One thing that I noticed recently, while you're still here, TSM, is that there was a Salazar quote in earlier in this chapter, I want to say, and I got giddy because I realized that I have a voice I use for Salazar now that I made for ACV.
Which means that whenever Salazar speaks in any of the fics that I do, he's going to talk like this. Because Salazar is now based on Antonio Banderas for some reason.
So that's him. That's Salazar. And you can blame David the Athenai for that. That is entirely his fault.
As casually as possible, Antonius looked around the Wizengamot chamber. Casilda Selwyn was not looking in his direction. Instead, she seemed focused on retrieving... She seemed focused on reviewing paperwork while completely ignoring both his presence and the pomp and circumstance of the proceedings. With a grimace, he opened the note carefully. With a grimace, he opened up the note carefully, almost as if he were afraid of getting bitten by the paper.
Beloved cousin Antonius, grandfather has taken an interest in these proceedings, as well as other recent family matters. He desires a meeting of the five families tomorrow evening. Dinner will begin promptly at 8 o'clock, followed by a gathering in the ballroom. A particular interest to our paterfamilias is your son, young Cassius. Grandfather has some questions for him regarding the events which led to the expulsion of our dear cousin, Miranda Bonnevie, from Hogwarts. I so look forward to dining with you and your family. Until then, I remain your devoted cousin, Casilda.
Wait, Blood, you've never heard the original... you've never heard... You have to have heard me this. I do this voice all the time. Oh, come on.
It's only this voice, isn't it? This is the voice I used to use for Salazar Slytherin. It was a little bit more understandable than this. I've developed it since then. But now, this is my voice for Argus Filch. It's an old man from Yorkshire. Used to be from Lancashire, but he moved, you see. So now he's... this is what I talk like. I got it from the Song of Ice and Fire audiobooks. Exactly, as ACR 100 says, this is the voice that drew the three series for Walder Frey in the Song of Ice and Fire audiobooks. And every time Argus Filch comes up,
because it's funny, is when I was recording Posse all the time, I couldn't figure out what voice I wanted to do for Filch, and I came up with that voice or. Yoinked it from Roy Dotrice. Well, I realized that later after I was like, oh, that's where I got it from. It was going to be for Salazar for ACV. And me and Matt loved that voice so much that when we decided to change the voice to the Spanish accent, we're like, well, we got to keep it on something. What I was like, okay, I'll put it on Filch. And then I realized only after the fact that Filch and Walder Frey are played by the same fucking person. I didn't realize that when I decided to make that Filch's voice. But it fits very well. Yeah, I saw a Twitter thread recently about how, about his inconsistency in his voices throughout the audiobooks, and it's like, yeah, that's a fair point. That is a fair point. I can't argue that. But fuck you. At the same time, he's great. You know, I don't really have an answer to it because it is. It's unprofessional. Like, it's unprofessional. Well, he doesn't have the world record, though, does he? And that's because, see, here's the thing. did he then take it from Dale? Because I don't know that you would count Dotrice's voices, because you could count Dale's voice... You can count Dale's voices as distinct for Harry Potter. I'll buy that. I won't buy it for Dotrice. Dotrice has about 15 or so voices. Maybe 30 at the most. Well, I mean, I don't know when. I don't know the timing on it. I know that when Jim Dale had it for Harry Potter 7, the number began with like 1 or 2, I think. Definitely not 3. Yeah, maybe Dutrice took it. I don't know what the criteria are, because I mean, a lot of Dutrice's voices you can't tell apart, and I mean that's going to be any, you know, that's going to be any actor, but like, you know, the voice he uses for Brienne or Brienne, as he says, is the same voice you see like slaps onto Arya Stark in book 4 and 5 or 5 or whatever. Like, that's one of the weird shifts, is she suddenly talks like Brienne does, the really harsh Irish accent. And you can do caps in here, in this channel. I made sure of it. But yeah, like I really like Dutrice's audiobooks, but the voices that he does are not as varied as the number of characters he did would suggest. That is a fair assessment. Yeah, the first 3 are more consistent. He changes Jamie between books 1 and 2 and then 3. because like, okay, like,
at first, this is Jaime Lannister's voice. I use this voice for various characters. You know, it's like, there is no one like me. There is only me.
That's the read, like, at the end, you know, when they have him drunk, when Catelyn has him drunk before she sets him free, and then in book 3 when he's rocking around with Brienne, he picks up the Lannister family Welsh, and I like that voice for him too, but at the same time,
he voices Cersei Lannister in this manner, but makes her Welsh beginning in book 4.
And I saw people on Twitter saying that Tyrion is from Yorkshire originally, and I didn't know enough about the Yorkshire accent at the time to tell whether that's true. I thought he was always Welsh, though. But again, I figured out what a Welsh accent sounded like from a combination of listening to the Game of Thrones audiobooks and listening to the Jim Dale Harry Potter audiobooks, because Jim Dale does Centaur's Welsh, and Dutrice does, for the most part, Lannister's Welsh. And I put two and two together, and I'm like, is that what Welsh sounds like? Because I'd probably heard it at some point before. Oh, yeah, I probably picked it up during, like, when I was watching Torchwood. That really stuck in my brain. Yeah, it's like, I'm sure there was a gap in production. You can still go back and listen to the old shit, though. Like, I'm not gonna defend him for that. I think that's sloppy. Like, I don't know what conditions he was recording under. He was also getting on in years. He's dead now. He died at age 98. I'm not gonna say a word against the guy, but when people say he changed the voices and that was stupid, yeah, that was stupid. He shouldn't have done that. You know, that's not good business. I will say, before I get back to the text, I will say that when he fucks up and pronounces Joffrey as Jeffrey, that's adorable, and I have permanent, that lives rent-free in my brain when he says Jeffrey. It is the funniest fucking thing in the world, and anyone that thinks that that's a genuine problem can fuck off. No, it's fine. Look, I have control over whether I ramble. And I'm not, I haven't lost a single listener during the ramble anyway, so. Also, any clan members, check clan. I need some rubber duck. And shut your fucking mouths about it too. You know, you don't say a word about it. That cannot leave that fucking server. Okay. Answering a DM, and now I'll get back to the regularly scheduled fucking shit. Okay. This will be for Ohana.
Antonius Warrington stared at the seemingly innocuous note for a long time. So long, in fact, that the court reporter had to call out the name Warrington twice before he finally noticed and rose from his seat.
Antonius Old Warrington speaks for the Warrington seat. One vote. I don't remember his voice, but that's just that should be fine. That's just the one thing. I'll check that later. I think I was planning to change his voice anyway.
Warrington sat back down stiffly. Then he blushed slightly in embarrassment as he noticed Corbin Yaxley smirking at his discomfort while holding up a similar note he had just received himself. Seconds later, Yaxley rose and addressed the court reporter.
Corbin Lord Yaxley speaks for the Yaxley seat. One vote.
The roll call having been completed, the court reporter turned towards Dumbledore.
Chief Warlock! 255 votes have been cast to open this emergency session of the Wizengamot. The quorum of 220 votes has been met.
So noted, Dumbledore said. Then he pulled out his wand and touched it to a small globe on his desk, which lit up in response.
As Chief Warlock, I hereby call this emergency session to order.
And so, with the preliminaries out of the way, the Wizengamot's business began in earnest. End of chapter 8.
I think he spoke before this, but I'm not certain.
If he didn't speak before this, that's fine.
Let me say.